Welcome to Windrush What's Next? The Struggle for Justice, a brand new broadcast series which has been commissioned by the Black Cultural Archives to examine the aftermath of the Windrush scandal. This entire series was recorded and produced during lockdown and is funded by the Paul Hamlin Foundation. I am your host, Sinai Flary, and this series is dedicated to all Windrush survivors and the late Windrush campaigner, Paulette Wilson. In this episode, I speak to Erike Orke, Managing Director of the Black Cultural Archives, about their work and response to the Windrush scandal. And I will be talking to Rosa Boateng, the Black Cultural Archives Archive Supervisor, about the Black Cultural Archives' oral histories, about the personal experiences of the Windrush generation's arrival in Britain. And later, I speak to public historian Kelly Foster about the importance of keeping family records and how the shredding of Windrush landing cards was just one part in a long line of actions that devastated the lives of so many people. But first, I speak to Erike Orke, Managing Director at the Black Cultural Archives.
Tell us about your role at the Black Cultural Archives and what it entails.
We are the home of Black British history. Our charity has been around since the 1980s, the early 1980s, very much as a community response to what was going on at the time, which really mirrors what's going on now in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement, in terms of whether Black history is included and taught in schools, in terms of the maiming of monuments or the presence of Black history physically in Britain's streets and buildings. So Black Cultural Archives has a really big role, and some of our role is advocating for our community. So when the Windrush scandal, when the news of it, I guess, broke in 2018, it was before I was working at Black Cultural Archives, but BCA held an emergency public meeting. Our chair, Dawn Hill, was one of the people who organised that public meeting. It was attended by press. It was attended by people who were now panicking and worried that they were not going to be able to access their healthcare, that were going to be able to access jobs anymore, might be deported, their children's university places being called into question. It affected every part of people's lives. And so that was an immediate response by BCA. And we've had an evolving response to that since, which I can tell you a bit more about as we discuss.
When did you yourself become aware of the scandal? Was it when the news broke in the media, or was you aware of things happening more at ground grassroots level?
For me, myself, it was when the news broke, but I was aware already of the implications of what successive governments have been up to, if you like. My heritage is Nigerian and British. I'm the middle of three sisters. Me and my big sister, we were born in Hull and lived in Nigeria for a time when we were children. My little sister was born in Hull and hasn't ever lived in Nigeria, but because of the time that she was born, she was not automatically a British citizen. So even in my own family, we were aware of the issues, but we were not, or I was not aware of the extent to which the development of government policy and approach of the Home Office as it was then was actually going to weaponize these measures, these legislative measures, against communities, which, as you know, the Home Office, the Home Secretary at the time, Amber Rudd, in 2018, she had to resign from her post as a result of this crisis.
The BCA is at the centre of our community. It's the only place, well, the only National Heritage Centre that is dedicated to collecting and preserving and celebrating the histories of people who are of African and Caribbean heritage in the UK. You know, such an important place. How did the community respond to the events and surgeries that you put on at the BCA in response to the Windrush scandal?
There was a huge response. So the first public meeting back in 2018 was followed by a series of impromptu surgeries staffed by lawyers giving their time for free, especially the lawyer firm Mackenzie Butter and Pope. So Jackie Mackenzie is one of the leading legal voices from the community talking about this process. So at that point in 2018, it was very much kind of almost like a triage of what are your needs, how does this affect you, here are your rights kind of surgeries. As the government's response evolved, they, as I say, Amber Rudd resigned, the government issued an apology, they commissioned the Wendy Williams Lessons Learned Review, and they also set up the Windrush Compensation Scheme. The Windrush Compensation Scheme is pretty different to any other compensation scheme because it actually takes into account the emotional and mental toll that was visited on our communities and other communities as well. So while that part of the compensation scheme is good, accessing the compensation scheme is a series of hurdles, either real or perceived. They're still barriers, they're still hurdles for people to get over. And so our current Black Cultural Archives current series of free legal surgeries, which we managed to reopen after the lockdown a couple of weeks ago, so they're on Saturdays now, at our building, One Windrush Square. Our current series with Jackie Mackenzie of Mackenzie Butter and Pope is focusing on accessing the compensation scheme. So the first ones were about what are your rights, how does the scandal affect you. This series is about how can you access the compensation scheme? And in addition to those surgeries, Black Cultural Archives, we were also invited to sit on the cross-government Windrush Working Group, which is a working group of individuals giving their time voluntarily to ensure that the Lessons Learned Review that was created by Wendy Williams is implemented by the government and by the Home Office, which are slightly separate things.
As somebody who works so close with the African and Caribbean community, how do you think the government and ministers can get this right and right the wrongs of the Windrush scandal and begin to repair some of the damage that's been done? Because our community is absolutely broken by this. You know, these are our grandparents, our great grandparents, and sometimes our parents who came here and gave up everything to give so much to the UK, and they seem to have just been forgotten.
It's more than being forgotten. It's insulting, and it's an aggressive move, of course, for people who have not only done what we, you know, celebrate about the NHS, the postal service, working in transport, but have also been some of, you know, the leading lights of British communities, like Dame Jocelyn Barrow, who was one of the people who was a governor at the BBC, for example, or Baroness Fluella Benjamin, who was so important to me growing up, and I'm sure to everybody else. You know, there are people of the Windrush generation who have been not only building Britain's infrastructure, but also building British society at the highest level. So yeah, incredibly insulting that the scandal ever happened, and that part of the scandal, in fact, was the shredding of the landing cards for people who had arrived as part of the Windrush period of time, which in itself is really terrible record-keeping practice. So speaking as an archivist, that also cuts deep. So what can ministers and Home Office officials and civil servants generally start to get right? I think a sincerity and authenticity of approach, which is something that I am seeing from the Home Office staff members that I've interacted with as part of the Lessons Learned Review implementation. They do seem to have taken it very deeply to heart, but they do need support from their bosses. the government, the ministers, senior management level, etc. They need that support and that commitment to actually long-standing and overhaul cultural change within their working practices and how they see our communities and how they understand themselves as part of a British society that is not monocultural and is not there just to service one type of British person, but is actually there to service everybody who lives here.
There's so much that they could do. One of the suggestions that we've been seeing a lot of on social media is in the inclusion of Black British history into the school curriculum. Is this something that you would support as somebody who, you know, you work at the Black Cultural Archives, you study our history daily? Is this something that is really important and needs to get into schools?
Absolutely, 100%. And this is something that Black Cultural Archives has been working on for 40 years, as we are 40-ish next year. And it's something that others, like the Black and Asian Studies Association, have been campaigning for. Teachers groups have been campaigning for. You know, Black History Month being set up in London in 1987. That was, you know, something that those activists in 1987 were campaigning for. And I would also like to note the work that the Runnymede Trust have done on a lot of research and creating and resources, creating teacher training courses, creating professional development courses. So all of this work is going on outside of government. The missing piece of the jigsaw is support from the government, whoever they may be, because it's something that's been going on for decades. So it's not just one particular government. Anyone who's in government needs to support this.
This year has been really, really trying and testing for our community, not just with the COVID-19 pandemic, which has highlighted a lot of inequalities, but also with the murder of George Floyd in the US and then the rebirth almost of the Black Lives Matter movement. The Black Cultural Archives is even more important now with the Black Lives Matter movement and protests that are taking place, not just in America, but right here on our doorstep. What do you make of this newfound liberation of the Black community?
Do you think it's liberation? It's a continuance of our fighting and our struggle. And I do see that our voices and our opinions and our issues have been amplified and given more of a platform because of the fallout of the murder of George Floyd. I don't know if we can say liberation quite yet, but maybe. And where, I feel like I've gone off on one, but where does Black Cultural Archives fit in this? You know, so we, like everyone else in March, had to put our building, One Windrush Square, into lockdown. And some of the reasons why that was so concerning for us was not just the normal reasons of like, okay, how are we going to survive this? How are we going to look after the team? How do we actually work remotely when, you know, I had to get funding just to buy laptops for people to work from home. I had to get funding to transfer things onto the cloud. So not just those operational issues, but also understanding that our mission as an organization absolutely means that we couldn't stop working. There was no way we could put our mission on hold. And so while the front of house team, we were able to put them onto the furlough scheme so that we could still support their jobs during the lockdown, the office staff kept working. And so we kept putting out digital programs of discussions and talks. We kept putting out exhibitions online. We kept putting out a lot of work. And it was incredibly important to us that we were able to get One Windrush Square opened again as soon as possible. So we opened the building towards the end of August. It's got limited opening hours. There's limited stuff that you can do in there, but it was still really important that we could open it. So we have a garden in the front now, which we didn't have before the pandemic, so that it's still a sanctuary, so people can still have somewhere to go that is removed from all of the drama and unhappiness of 2020. But our library is open again, which means that every day that since we opened the building after the lockdown, we've had researchers in there of all different ages, young people doing their essays, TV researchers getting material for their programs and their documentaries. academics, you know, we've had people, artists have been using it as well. We've had people in every day using those collections because we are the only place that has that mission to actively preserve and document and make accessible our history. So yeah, super vital. And I'm really pleased to share that we've been able to access some funding that means that we will be able to keep BCA going despite the effect of the pandemic.
That's really good to hear. In the age of Black Lives Matter and everything that's going on, would you say you've had more interest or more visitors come in or more diverse range of people coming into the BCA?
I don't think we've had a more diverse range of people coming into the building, although I'm only there one day a week because of the COVID issues. But we definitely had a huge upswing of the types of people, types of organisations and amount of interest there is generally in BCA. So people getting in touch with us by email, by phone, people visiting our website. We can see like website visits from America and the Netherlands and Germany kind of coming up. Yeah, so and Brazil as well. So some it's actually been like very interesting that there has been a kind of boost in who is interested in the work that we do. For example, we were featured in Tatler magazine in August, which is, you know, a high society, very, very white English magazine. So that was very curious. We weren't expecting that bit of coverage. Right? Oh, okay. Nice.
Maybe they're trying to generate some allies and putting you as a point of contact or a point of resource for information.
Yeah, that's what it was. I mean, it was very nice to see that happening at that with the particular type of audience that they have. But yeah, in terms of people coming in, I think there's still the effect of coronavirus that are making people not want to travel so much. So people have been coming in, but it has been like it hasn't changed that much from before the pandemic in terms of who is visiting the building. But we have always had different sorts of people visit, from you know, young families to elders to politicians. Like, a lot of types of people have visited our building in the past as well.
Tell us a little bit about the different things that can be accessed at the BCA and where people can contact you online.
So our website is blackculturalarchives.org.uk. I think we're the top result on Google if you Google Black Cultural Archives. So we're really easy to find. We do have a Google Arts and Culture platform, which has just very little exhibits, you know, just exhibits that you could look at on your tea break. And that's g.co/Black Cultural Archives. And that's one of the only resources available all year round internationally for Black British history. On our main website, you can find more exhibitions, more resources to help you if you're doing research. We also have a YouTube page, which has recordings of our events, including the Windrush conference that Patrick Vernon produced with us. That was an incredible conference. So that is available on our YouTube channel now. October, which for most people is Black History Month, for BCA it's Black Futures Month. And so over the course of the month, we'll be releasing videos curated by our early career curator, Palumi Obubanjo, with thinkers and leaders talking about where we're going next as a community. So there's lots going on. And if you visit our building, you can see the current exhibition, which is Breaking Barriers, which is portraits of 5 Black women leaders by leading Black British photographer Joy Gregory. So tons and tons going on. The best way to get in touch with us is, if you want to email us, it's info@bcaheritage.org.uk, or just go to our website or follow us on social media.
Thank you so much. It's so nice that you mentioned their Black future. How would you describe the future of us Black Britons in the years to come? What would you like to see it look like?
I would just like to see people thriving. I am so pleased and delighted about Black Pound Day, that occurred just naturally and then has been embraced and then is carrying on. I see the future as being one in which our entrepreneurship, our creativity, and our vast diversity within our community, whether that's, you know, diversity of people from Senegal to Jamaica, or people who are Black and trans, or people who are, you know, Black and gay, or what have you, like the huge diversity within our community. I just want to see that on a platform and shining and thriving forever. But more and more, and just I think that the way that the communities have started to come together more to support each other on things like Black Pound Day, for example, or in their support of BCA, I think possibly in the past we've not always been able to work together, and I see that happening more and more, that we're collaborating, we're partnering, we're helping each other kind of stand on each other's shoulders and giving each other legs up. And I think that's what our future holds, and what I want to see more and more of.
Arike, this is a great chance to bring in the Black Cultural Archives Archive Supervisor, Rosa Boateng. Archive Supervisor. That job sounds really interesting. Can you tell us a bit more about your role and what a typical working day or working week looks like for you?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. So my role is kind of looking after the collections that we have and making sure that they're accessible. And making sure that people can use them for research. So we've got, like I said, over 3,500 records and over 40 collections. So it's a lot of material, and it's really broad in terms of covering like history, sociology, you know, like creative practice, very broad collections. And my job is just to make sure that these collections are accessible to the public, and to make sure that they're being preserved so that over time, you know, people can access these collections for generations to come. So, I mean, it's quite hard right now to say what a typical working week is, you know, in a global pandemic. But before the pandemic, the typical working week would be keeping our reading room open. So at BCA, we've got a dedicated reading room where we also have a library. So people come in every day to do research from the archive collection and from the library collection. And my job is really just to facilitate that. So to get people the materials that they need and to answer any questions on that. Also taking care of new donations. So our collections are quite unique from different archives in the sense that they're really kind of active and they're being added to all the time. We get many donations from people who really, you know, have come across materials that they think need to be preserved. So kind of talking to those people, finding out about what they'd like to give us and taking care of that exchange also.
Okay. Now, you mentioned there that the BCA archives have over 3,500 records. What exactly are in those records? If you could tell us what they contain specifically, or topics or areas that they cover.
Mm-hmm. So they're very, very broad. And Black Cultural Archives kind of grew out of a community response to really like damaging effects of like systemic racism. So a lot of our materials are kind of like activist responses and activist campaigns, a lot of educational material. BCA kind of also grew out of different education initiatives such as supplementary schools, trying to give Black children a better education, you know, in a climate that wasn't educating Black kids. So we have a lot of material that's kind of covering that kind of educational response. We've got material that is responding to, for instance, like Black women's concerns, so the Black women's movement in the 70s and 80s, responses to upheavals such as the Brixton uprisings in 1981, to more modern collections that covering the history of Black dance in the UK. So they're as broad as collections go. So it's kind of hard to tell you what's in 3,500 records, but those are kind of some of the subject areas that we cover.
Yeah, it sounds like a wide range. And just for our listeners, if they wanted to donate to the archives, you mentioned earlier that you accept new donations. What sort of things can be donated, and is there anything that cannot? So, for example, if you had an old letter from a family member or old photographs, can those be donated? And specifically, please tell us if there's anything that can't.
So our collections policy is quite broad. So we're really looking for materials that tell the story of African descent people in the UK, mainly from the post-war period, but we have collections that cover before that. As you know, we've been here for a very long time. So we kind of deal with things on a case-by-case basis. So when you're saying people donating, you know, like family photographs and letters, that's something that we are interested in. I guess we're looking for unique records that help paint a more comprehensive picture of Black presence in the UK, you know, why we're here, how we got here, and the work that's been going on. Anything that kind of spotlights the contributions of Black people in the UK, anything that can really help researchers, historians, and people just interested in Black history paint a broader picture of Black presence is what we're after.
Okay, fantastic. And is there anything people can't donate?
Yeah, it's a really broad question. But yeah, there are definitely materials that we wouldn't accept. I mean, we get a lot of materials that are about Black history but have a solely American focus, for instance, right. Which is, you know, really valuable material, but we're really looking to what's happening in the UK, although we're aware that because of like different migration routes, it's quite complicated, right? And, you know, things have kind of like diasporic travel routes, but we are looking to tell the stories of people in the UK. So if there was material that was like in no way related the UK, then maybe that's something that would go to another home, not the BCA. If there was material that we couldn't for some reason authenticate in any way, maybe some more work would have to be done before it came to BCA. So those are some of the things that we're thinking about, but like I said, it's really on a case-by-case basis.
Okay, thank you so much for that. And I know, you know, family records, archives are extremely important, but I wanted to hear from you, how important are the archives in telling the stories of Black British communities and specifically the Windrush generation?
I think archives are really fundamental, and I think BCA and the way that BCA collects is really instrumental in thinking about like what is an archive, what is a reliable historical record, like what do our histories look like and how they're told. And so if you're talking about the Windrush generation, for instance, I think what's really unique about BCA's collections are the amount of oral history collections and oral history records that we have. And those are really key because it's people telling their own stories. So it's putting, it's kind of uplifting people's personal history. It's uplifting the fact that we can tell our own stories and not have to look to, you know, other people to tell them. It's complicating the picture of Black presence in the UK in terms of, like, within an oral history, you can have someone talking about, you know, events like the 1958 race riots in Notting Hill, also juxtaposed with, you know, what that was like for them as someone just trying to do their food shopping. You know, it tells a historical narrative on so many registers, you know, personal and political.
Yeah, and I think there's something really special about listening to oral histories. As soon as you hear somebody's voice, you're not just hearing the words they're saying. You can imagine what they look like. You can imagine their mannerisms. Mm-hmm. You know, it really does add a lot of colour and warmth to the stories, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I think if you can look at those recordings alongside, you know, other forms of history telling, whether it's like books or journals, all of those things together can tell a story that's so much more complete, I think, just by having that like subjective account of history.
Rosa, can you share with us some examples of oral histories that you have in the collection that are specifically from the Windrush generation?
Yeah, sure. So we've got different collections in the oral history archives that are around the Windrush generation. So it's different oral history projects that have been carried out over the years from 1991 onwards that are documenting the testimonies of people who are part of the Windrush generation. So the accounts are really varied. So you hear from iconic figures such as Connie Mark, for instance, alongside people who were on SS Windrush, people who were on that ship. And they tell quite a varied account in terms of covering themes like arrival and employment, social life, family, and different types of like resistance to struggles that they faced at that time. So they're really, really varied stories, and they come from different oral history collecting initiatives over the past 30 years.
Thank you. And we know oral histories play a vital part in preserving the history and experiences of the Windrush generation. Let's take a listen now to some of those oral histories from the BCA's collection, such as Connie Mark, who tells us about living in England with hardships. Henry Joseph discusses his working life, and Mr. Simmons breaks down the culture shock he experienced making a new life in Britain.
I get very annoyed that people don't want to accept and that people were made ignorant of the fact how very much the West Indies were involved in the war, in the last war, and how very much we were brought up to love the King, love the Queen, to love our country and to respect our country. And then now when you come here, what do you see? You see a sign saying, no blacks, no Irish, no dogs, no children. That hurt, that really used to hurt. But like most things in life, what could you do? If you in a house and a landlord don't like you, when you come on a Friday evening, you find the things upstairs in the steps. So I hope people realize, as bad as they think they are now, in the way they are much better than we were.
Windrush. I had a few discrimination against me. The first was when I applied after being out of employment, after leaving was sat from Lambson and Paragon, I went to the labor exchange, registered as a sheet metal worker. About 2 days before, there appeared in the newspapers vacancies for sheet metal worker at a certain firm in Cricklewood, in Holborn rather. When I went to the labor exchange, they gave me a card to go to this firm. When I reached the gate, the security man at the gate, he took the card from me and he read it. Immediately as he read the card, he handed it back to me, saying, the vacancies are filled. So I went back to the labor exchange, and I said, how could you send me here when the vacancies... The man said, how are the vacancies filled when it was in the papers up to yesterday, which was Sunday, and this morning it is still there? He said, I wonder why. I said, don't ask me why, I know why. Anyway, I left him, and I went away. Then I found this job with the British Rails. When working with the Metal Box Company, I left there during 1979, and I found a job as a sheet metal worker with a firm in Tottenham. They used to have made these neon signs. I started to work there. 8 o'clock in the morning, I reported for duty. We started to work from about 9 o'clock. We worked until around 10, when they called tea break. Myself and all the other employees, 15 of them were there, sat down and we had tea. We went off, started working, then went off for lunch. After lunch, I was called by the manager, who told me that he's sorry, he cannot retain me, because my work was not satisfactory. I said, you tested me before you took me on, and you found me satisfactory then. How come now you have found my work unsatisfactory? He says, well, this is how it goes. Time changes. I said, well, that's not satisfactory to me, your explanation. He said, anyway, have no fear, I'm going to pay you for the entire day. I said, that is not the point. The point is, I want you to come clean. Why are you giving me the marching orders after being satisfied with my test prior to employing me? I said, anyway, I'll see you. Well, my intention was to have gone to the labor exchange and reported this. But as I was going out, he called me back. He said, Mr. Joseph, one word. I went back. He said, I'll tell you the truth. It was not my doing. He said, those men you see there, they have been with me, some for 15, some for 20 years. And they told me in no uncertain terms that if I am kept on in employment there, they are going to quit. In other words, they have pulled me over the barrel for employing a black man as a sheet metal worker. And it was as clear as that. But I tell you, if I had the knowledge that I gained after studying industrial laws and injuries insurance, I would have happened up the chute. But at that time, I was ignorant of the laws. So he escaped.
Windrush.
So coping with mortgage and all the items that go with family life, I had no room in my life for too much of the socializing. I was never on. Perhaps it's everybody has a little fault. Mine is that I'm too introvert. I was never an outgoing, good mixing person. I didn't care much about friends or getting away. I don't like noise. I don't like groups, you know, parties, dancing, all those things. They didn't interest me. I had a job, you know. To me, my family was like a job. And I had to get there and get it done. As long as they had something to eat. It's hard to explain
what it feels like coming from a tropical background and to take on riding a bicycle in freezing temperature and to tell yourself, well, I've got to do it. You don't really want it if you had a choice, you know, but those were the hard years. But I persevered and we got by. We just sort of got by. We were never in any financial trouble. We never don't like owing anything. I worry if a bill came in and it wasn't paid the same week. It was still sitting around. It is an obsession that I inherited from my background. Because if you have come from a well-off family, well, there are many West Indians whose parents, whose background are reasonably wealthy, you know, the parents had. Perhaps the way they would relate to you would probably give you a little different picture about life in the West Indies. But I didn't come from affluence. I didn't come from the upper middle income group. I came from the earth, you know, right down there. But I don't intend to go back. I'm like the chap who crawls up the hill and digs in. If I move one foot up, I hang in there and I drive a peg in and I tie myself to it. And I don't mean to slip down. That has always been my attitude to life.
Yeah, absolutely. And for the public and our listeners as well, how can they access the archives?
So right now, like I say, in the middle of a pandemic, a little bit difficult. In a kind of usual scenario, you would send us an email, so you can get us on archives@bcaheritage.co.uk or go to our website, which you can just find by Googling Black Cultural Archives. And you would send us an email and book an appointment with us to come in and view our archive collections. And on our website, we've got an online catalogue. So there's listings of everything that we have. So you can find out what it is you'd like to view. And then you can also send us an email if you have a sense of, you know, what you might like to see, but you're unsure of how to navigate the catalogue. So after that conversation, we'd book you in and then you come to our reading room where you view the materials. Because of lockdown, the reading room is closed because our building is closed. But we do have collections available to view online. So we've got a platform with Google Arts and Culture where you can view different exhibits made up of archive materials. And there's actually one specifically to do with the Windrush generation and post-war migration.
Thank you so much. I've been speaking to Arike Oke, the BCA's Managing Director.
And Rosa Boateng, the Black Cultural Archives Archive Supervisor.
Thanks so much, Sinai. Lovely to speak to you.
Windrush, what's next? The struggle for justice in memory of Paulette Wilson.
Now, I speak to public historian Kelly Foster about the importance of keeping our family records and how the shredding of Windrush landing cards was just one part in a long line of actions that devastated the lives of so many people. How significant was the shredding of the Windrush landing cards to the beginning of the Windrush scandal?
To me, when we look at that situation, it was the culmination of the destruction of these archival records by the state, in addition to the hostile environment that escalated what we now know today as the Windrush betrayal or Windrush scandal. But it's important to remember and recognise that the hostility towards these British citizens was ongoing. It didn't start with the destruction of the landing cards. It started with the extension of these racist immigration laws and even policies that were going back to the 1940s. So in 2010, the Home Office took the decision to destroy, I think it was around 8 million landing cards. And these were cards that were completed by Customs Border Control when somebody entered the country. The cards included biographical information, name, sex, date of birth, nationality, place of birth, as well as things like occupation, address, length of stay. And for many of the people who have been affected by the Windrush betrayal, this was one of the key records that they had to prove their citizenship. I, along with a number of other historians, did a Freedom of Information Act request to the Home Office in 2018 when we learned of the destruction of the landing cards as a result of Amelia Gentleman's investigative journalism. And the reason they gave for the destruction, or the justification they gave for the landing cards being destroyed, was that they were no longer of business value and had no historic value. So the question broadly needs to be asked is, who is the person who is placing these value judgments on whether these records, which has transformed people's lives, are considered to be of either a historic value or be of a value to demonstrate and prove someone's citizenship and arguably their humanity in the eyes of the British state. Now, it's interesting to look a bit further at the work that was published by Amelia Gentleman in the book The Windrush Betrayal, to read about the whistleblower at the Home Office and the number of different Home Office employees who, in I think 3 years prior to 2010, were pushing for the destruction of the landing cards to be reconsidered. The argument that is given is that the landing cards were destroyed, as well as other records that were held at Luna House in Croydon, in the Home Office offices there, was because that site was being sold off to developers and they wanted to clear that site. So you had the compounding of, well, essentially the state, the decision makers, seeing no value at all in these historic records. I think they were speaking about the option of digitising them because there may be some value or interest for family historians. It was judged that they were it was too expensive to digitise them so that they were accessible online. It was suggested that they could be donated to a black cultural organisation. That also wasn't taken forward, and this was all before 2010, before they were eventually destroyed. So there were a number of different opportunities there to save these important records from destruction. So we've lost not only for the individuals that have been affected, who have lost not only records proving their citizenship, but we've also lost a very important historic record as well because of that racist value system, or the racist value system of the people who are in charge of making those decisions.
Yeah, I'm actually shocked to hear that they thought there was no historic value of these landing cards, considering, you know, these are people who were invited here, who worked, who contributed to this country. Those landing cards are part of British history. So it's really shocking to hear that they didn't see any value in them.
Yeah, when I say no longer of business value or historic value, that is a quotation taken directly from the response to the Freedom of Information Act request that we put into the Home Office. So that is a matter of government record. And it's interesting because, you know, the destruction of the landing cards came around 3 years after 2007, which was the anniversary of the bicentenary of the abolition of the slave trade. And during that year, there were a number of different government-sponsored events. And there was also a really important campaign around digitised records that was led by the likes of Arthur Torrington, who is a co-founder, I should say, of the Windrush Foundation and the website Legali, to make free to access the records of the slave compensation registers, which were essentially a series of censuses done of the enslaved in the British Empire. And those records were digitised by Ancestry, that kind of website that many of whom may know their name, Ancestry.com, if you're interested in doing family history research. And the model that Ancestry uses is to charge people to access the digitised records, which ordinarily the hard copies can be accessed at the National Archives. So that already sort of a few years before, there was this campaign to enable people who are descended from enslaved Africans to access this material for free that would have otherwise been commercialised. And then you also had this conversation going on in the Home Office about whether there was value to be had in landing cards. I think an important thing to remember is that this was the Home Office making this decision without consulting, or as far as I know, without consulting the National Archives, without consulting any or without there being a process to consult anybody that may have a broader overview of what could be considered to be of historic value. This was, as far as I can tell, was a unilateral decision taken by the Home Office without any intervention from any other department. And it's also worth giving a bit of anecdotal evidence as well. This is from archivists who are working within the local authority archives. I've heard from a number of archivists that after the hostile environment policy, they saw an uptick in inquiries coming into the local records office. So in London, that's the local authority archives for the London boroughs, of people wanting to find records about their schooling or about places that they may have worked. And this was quite a significant increase. And this was people who were, because of the hostile environment policy, required to produce ridiculous amounts of paper-based records about their residency in the country. So we have essentially the demand or requirement of people who were British citizens at the time of their arrival, and most definitely British citizens by dint of their ancestry, and that is, you know, their ancestry of being descended from colonised subjects, having to prove that they had the right to be treated as citizens in this country. And that is all down to, you know, quite literally what the archive says, what the records show. It reminds me of something that the scholar Derrida said, which is there is no political power without control of the archive. So when the proof of our humanity and our citizenship lies within the person who controls the archive, and there is a destruction of that proof, what does that then mean for how people are treated and how people can exercise their rights?
We've had many people over the last few years come out and say the Windrush scandal was unavoidable.
I think it's important, from my perspective, it's important to have even a broader historical overview. And I think oftentimes the narrative around Windrush, in inverted commas, is one that perhaps gives a rosier view of the actual voyage of the Empire Windrush in that summer of 1948. There was an unofficial policy of discouraging the movement of West Indians who want to come to the UK, and that's it was a policy of official discouragement, essentially. So we have this story about people being invited, and that did happen later in the 1950s, but in that immediate post-World War II period, and in the beginnings of people moving from, not the beginnings, I shouldn't say that, but the what today we might see as the beginnings of people moving from the Caribbean to the UK, we often, through 21st century lens, interpret that as a process that was welcomed by the British government in order to help repair the country. So if we think about that year, 1948 saw around, or just over actually, 60,000 what's called European voluntary service workers coming to the UK. So these are Europeans, Polish, Germans, Italians, who had been displaced through the war and who were coming to work in the UK. And compare that to the around just over 1,000 people that were on the Windrush. So in 1948, as I mentioned, and the ships that came before that as well. So we have a kind of very skewed view of what post-World II migration looked like, and indeed the place of colonial subjects, in inverted commas, in that broader post-World II migration history, and indeed in the broader history of kind of viewing Britain and the empire as well. So if we think about this unofficial policy of official discouragement. So this was because the UK could not prevent Caribbean people or anyone who, as a result of the 1948 Act, was a British citizen. They could not prevent anybody from coming to the UK legally, but they could disencourage them from setting out from their place, or the place where they were from in the first instance. So in the case of Jamaica, I know that they disencouraged people by making it really difficult for people to get a passport. By not, or during the war anyway, at the beginnings of the war, by disencouraging and not having recruitment officers actually in the Caribbean at the very beginning of the war, so that Caribbean people weren't able to volunteer and to sign up to fight in the British forces like was possible in other places. So there was these different ways in which there was this disencouragement. So, and even when the Windrush, when the Empire Windrush docked on the 21st, they didn't disembark until the 22nd, because again, there was a kind of panic by lawmakers, and they were looking for ways again to really encourage people to turn back, or encourage people not to settle here, not to think of this as a permanent, not to think of their settlement here as a permanent situation. So I think perhaps the kind of Windrush betrayal comes as a shock in the 21st century, because we have this celebratory idea of British multiculturalism and this story of especially Black Caribbean people being welcome. But when you look at the historic records of the period, that most definitely wasn't the case in 1948. That begins to change by the mid-1950s, when you see the likes of the NHS and British Rail and Transport for London beginning to recruit directly from the Caribbean in order to kind of fill this labour shortage. But there was this period in between that time where there wasn't that attitude at all.
And that's really important that you do highlight that, because I feel like very often, you know, we look at it like they were invited here, they helped build the NHS, they, you know, helped build so much institutions in Britain, and we kind of forget the hardships. And it's really important that we have a balanced view of what it was like for them back then. How significant is the Windrush generation to British history?
So how significant is the Windrush generation to British history? It's part of British history, you know. I think perhaps, again, what happened after World War II is that the teaching of British imperial history stopped, perhaps. And there began to be a kind of very narrow view of Britishness as being something that's kind of defined by the waters around Great Britain. But before then, you know, British history as taught in Britain or to British children was really a celebration of empire. And the celebration of empire, as problematic as it is, but was one that kind of encompassed the British Empire as a place, or the British Empire as a kind of global experience and territory on which the sun never sets, and gave a much more global view of what it meant to be British. And I think perhaps in the 70 years since the end of World War II, that has changed enormously, and it's become this very kind of parochial view of Britishness. And I guess we can see the results of that in the turn towards Brexit over the past few years, and a kind of very insular view of Britishness. To me, the significance of the people who are often called the Windrush generation, but the post-World War II migrants who came as British citizens to the United Kingdom are significant because they fought their way into British history. The reason why we remember the Empire Windrush in all of its complexities, or maybe not in all of its complexities, we simplify the memory of it somewhat, but the reason why it's become such a historic symbol in how we think of the 20th century is because of the efforts of those Windrush generation. And when I say Windrush generation, I mean quite literally the people who travelled on board the Empire Windrush and others. But I'm thinking specifically about people like Sam King and Oswald Denison, who's also known as Columbus of Brixton. They and their work, their organising, are part of the reason why we remember that as a significant moment of British history. But, you know, also people like Connie Mark. Connie Mark was a secretary in the British Army during World War II. She was also a kind of staunch advocate for the historic importance of the Empire Windrush, and also for Mary Seacole, and Mary Seacole being remembered as an important figure in British history. People like Baron Baker, who wasn't a passenger on board the Windrush, but did claim to be on the docks of Tilbury when it came in 1948. Baron Baker had been in the RAF during World War II, but instead of going back to Jamaica, he had stayed and had been an important sort of community organiser in 1948. People like Billy Strachan. Billy Strachan was another World War II veteran. He was in the RAF, an officer in the RAF, and he had stayed in the UK as well, and he was the leader of the Caribbean Labour Congress in 1948, which was one of the few, and perhaps even one of the only, kind of national Caribbean-led community organisations in the country in 1948, and he was an important, again, liaison and support for many of the passengers on board the Empire Windrush and the ships that came before it as well, who had significant difficulty in kind of making their way in the in England or in the UK in the late 1940s. So for me, what is, you know, I have a kind of quite a micro view of the Windrush generation. The work that I do tends to look very specifically at Brixton, and to think about the significance of Brixton in the kind of Windrush story and the connections between Brixton and the passengers of the Empire Windrush, and there are many. But we would not be remembering the significance of the Empire Windrush without the work and the vision and the dedication of the people who actually travelled on that ship. They made the history, they fought their way into what we think of as British history.
How would you like to describe their legacy, and how do you think they should be honoured? And do you think enough is being done to honour the Windrush generation in this country?
I have difficulties with how the Windrush story has been simplified and mythologised, and the inaccuracies that are considered to be historic fact. So, you know, it's a narrative that is very male. It's a narrative that has somehow become very Jamaican. And it's a narrative that is shaped around positioning ourselves as being part of the British state. And for me personally, I think that perspective tends to ignore and underplay the reasons as to why that is. So the poverty and destitution that was in the Caribbean at the beginning part of the 20th century that led for people to have to leave after World War II. By focusing on the nationalism and the kind of celebration of and the connection of the Empire Windrush with servicemen and women who fought in World War II means that we don't look more closely at the, as I said, at the destitution and the abandonment that was in that came with two British slave societies after emancipation or 100 years after emancipation. So for me, the Windrush, the Empire Windrush, is quite a uncomfortable history, really, and a very different history than the kind of story of national identity that is often that school children learn, for example. So, you know, I think especially to 2012, when the Olympic opening ceremony, which fittingly, I guess, was called Pandemonium, a part of it was called Pandemonium, included a kind of a float of this ship that was supposed to represent the Empire Windrush and a kind of number of suited and suitcased, you know, black men holding a grip and wearing suits, kind of wandering off the ship looking a bit puzzled. You know, so the Windrush is very much part of the national story, but I do wonder as to, because it's not being told in an accurate way, that people are surprised when we can see a continuation of that abandonment and kind of turning away from the mess of empire and turning away from the mess of slavery that led to and continues to lead to the Windrush scandal and people, you know, people's lives being disrupted and torn apart. And as to how the Windrush generation should be honoured and commemorated, I think in this moment, especially when there's been many conversations this year about memorialisation and commemoration, I do tend to think about, you know, what are the things that we are not commemorating? So we are not commemorating the self-defence that people had in order to protect themselves from racist attacks in the 1958 race riots, in inverted commas, that was in Notting Hill, in West London and in Nottingham, where you saw the black community in those neighbourhoods having to defend themselves against their racist neighbours. We don't commemorate that. We don't commemorate the likes of the father-in-law, for example, of Columbus of Brixton. So Columbus of Brixton, as I mentioned, was a passenger on board the Empire Windrush, and his name was Oswald Denison. And he was quite well covered in the British press. He had a number of different features about him in the newspapers in 1948. He stayed in Clapham Deep shelter for a period and eventually found a job as a sign writer in Balham. But Columbus's story is interesting because he then marries a woman that he met at a church tea party in South London. And the woman that he marries was a black woman. And her father had been a serviceman during World War One and had stayed on in the UK. I don't know much more about her father apart from the fact that he was black. So we, and even, you know, in mentioning, I mentioned Billy Strachan as well and the Caribbean Labour Congress. By not focusing more on these kind of individual stories and stories that go beyond and before 1948, we run the risk of making it seem like there is only one migration story in the post-World War II era. Mm-hmm. You know, where are the voices of women in this story when we think of the Empire Windrush? Where are the voices of the black British people who were here generations before 1948? Where are the voices of black people from other parts of the British Empire who also came to the UK in that post-World War II era? Yeah, I think rather than be in a rush to permanently memorialise, I would be more interested for there to be a broader understanding of the complexities of what we think of as the Windrush generation. I would also say as well that it's important to recognise that the whole reason that we think of the Empire Windrush in 1948 and the whole reason we even use the term Windrush in the way that we do is a shorthand meaning post-World War II migration of black people essentially from the British Empire is because of the efforts of quite literally the passengers on board the Empire Windrush. as far as I can tell, one of the first places to really commemorate the importance of the Empire Windrush was in 1988 on the 40th anniversary. The work that Black Cultural Archives did along with Lambeth Council, the work around oral histories that they were doing in 1988, and then in turn in 1998 on the 50th anniversary, we see Windrush Square in Brixton being named, and then we also see Wood Green, a plaque being put in Wood Green, and Bernie Grant calling for a Memorial Sunday in which we can memorialise Windrush passengers. And Bernie Grant, of course, was the Black MP for Tottenham. It's important to remember that it was the Windrush passengers who put this plan in action in order to commemorate it as a point of historical importance.
You have been listening to Windrush, What's Next? The Struggle for Justice with me, Sinai Flary, and my special guests, Arike Orke, Managing Director of the Black Cultural Archives, Rhoda Boateng, Archive Supervisor, again at the Black Cultural Archives, and public historian Kelly Foster. Plus, we went back in time to listen to members of the Windrush generation share their first-hand experiences of coming to Britain. Join me next time for episode 5, part 1 of a special 3-part series where we will be speaking about racial inequality, Black Lives Matter, and what this all means for our identity. On this show, I will be speaking to Dawn Hill, the current chair of the Black Cultural Archives, and Michael Braithwaite, Windrush campaigner and survivor. I hope you can join me then.
The Windrush What's Next series is supported by funds from the Paul Hamlin Foundation.